who've come into this course for the first time and have very little idea of what Buddhism means, both its directors, teaching, and also its depth. And sometimes, seeing those new people, I concentrate more on the breadth of the Buddha's teaching, especially how it flows into our daily lives, and how it makes sense and gives guidance through the actions of our daily lives. But now and again, you know, we recognize people who've been coming here for many years, who require something a bit less superficial, something which can penetrate deeper into their quest for understanding of the nature of their existence and their place in this universe, and how they should be dealing with the more profound problems of their existence, and being in the mood to address the second aspect of Buddha's teaching, the deeper part of Buddha's teaching. I'm going to be giving my talk this evening on the four foundations of mindfulness. The only reason being is someone asked me a question about this before I came in here. It prompted the mind to go in this direction. The four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha taught as the path, the way to become fully enlightened. Many people coming in here are coming on the quest to be fully enlightened. Do you want to be fully enlightened? Why? Do you know what you're letting yourself in for? Do you know what fully enlightened means? I'll ask this question first of all because as a young man I rejected Christianity because in Christianity one was asked to believe in a God and no one could give me a straight answer to describe what this God was. And he could not describe it nor tell me what this God did. And I found myself thinking, how can you believe in something which you don't know? How can you believe in something which is very characteristic and actions and functions? No one can explain to you. How can you believe in something which you don't know? When I first became interested in Buddhism, I wanted to be enlightened too. And I asked myself, what is this enlightenment anyway? And I asked some of the monks, and they couldn't give me a straight answer what this enlightenment was. Nor could they turn to it. And I started to understand in this early stage of being a Buddha that my belief in enlightenment saw some striking similarities to the belief in a God. Did you see that point? So, let's put aside the search for enlightenment until we understand what it is, what we're letting ourselves in for. In the way the Buddha taught, when he talked about the four foundations of mindfulness, he said that this is a path to the purification of being. That we can understand. The purification from what? From those habits of the mind which create problems in our lives. We call that defilement. Those things which take away our freedom to care, to be wise, to be responsible in this world. What causes a problem in your mind, in your life? These are tyrannical forces, such as unwise greed, hatred, fear, guilt. These are forces which very few people can resist. They arise in the mind and take over. And they make us do things which are quite irrational and hurtful to ourselves and others. We are not free. In the full sense of this term, we are not free until we have got some handle on these forces, which rage like a storm inside the human mind. The first thing is to recognize these things as raging tyrants, which take away that which we call our freedom. Anger takes away your freedom. Fear takes away your freedom. Guilt, love takes away your freedom. So instead of talking about enlightenment, we're talking about freedom. The freedom of the individual, the freedom of the mind. The freedom means that you can choose to go to the left or to the right. You're not just going to the left out of habit. You're not just going to the right out of some uncontrollable desire, an irresistible form. You are free to choose. The Buddha was talking, when he thought about the four foundations of mindfulness, as a way to achieve a freedom in the mind. It's a liberation of the mind. He just attempted to sit meditation for 30 minutes. And during the present moment, did you succeed? Did you want to succeed? Yes. Why didn't you? Because you're not free. There are forces in the mind, habitual forces, which stop you succeeding in the meditation. If you were free, you would have achieved. Because you did not, it means you're still tethered. Fettered to habits of the mind which stop you enjoying and relishing the profound peace of meditation. The Buddha said that there are the four foundations of mindfulness, these four focuses of mindfulness, if you wish, which lead to the freedom of the human being. The first thing one should say is these are ways of mindfulness which you develop, which are developed by one's own commitment and energy towards this goal. They are not something which you buy or which are given by somebody else. It's completely up to you. The Siddhist path towards the freedom and liberation of the mind is in the hands of each individual. It's up to you. You have to take responsibility for your freedom or your lack of it. And the four foundations are called the four foundations of mindfulness. This important word in the Buddhist path needs to be understood. It is a way, it is a means of practice, it is something to be developed which frees the human mind, which frees one from problems, which the Buddha said leads to the ultimate happiness. It is practice of mindfulness focused on four things for a certain purpose which I'll come up to later. What we mean by mindfulness is the clear, bright, penetrating awareness of what's going on. It seems like a simple thing to talk about mindfulness, the clear, bright awareness of what's going on. But, unfortunately, it's something which very few people possess. We think we know, but really all we know is the purpose of things. The way we use our mind is not very skillful at all. We use our mind in the way that we were taught, as creatures of habit, learning to look at things in the way we are told. The mindfulness which the Buddha encouraged was a powerful and penetrating mindfulness. It sees things the way they truly are. The mindfulness which we need to develop has to be full of energy. Clear, bright. It can be compared to having a bright light in a room. So bright that every corner, every particle of that room is fully illuminated. If that light was turned down and was dark and dim, there's many things which you would not be able to see in that room. If it was very dim, you would not be able to see colour, or you could see a shape as a larger object. The smaller things will disappear from your vision. The mindfulness can be compared to the light in the room. As we develop mindfulness, more and more and more things become bright and clear in our vision. When the mindfulness is very strong, it's a huge, powerful light, a great beam. which can see so much that one never thought existed before. This mindfulness is developed. It is not a natural possession of the human being. It is something that one can develop by care, by energy, by application of the mind. We have tried to meditate for 30 minutes. One of the other reasons why, one is in the power of the tyrannical forces that cause defilements in the mind. One of the reasons why one cannot stay with the breath is because the mindfulness is not sharp enough. In short, one does not know what one is doing. One cannot see the complete workings of your mind. One can only see flashes, heart rhythms. And what one sees as if through a dim window. The mindfulness is like cleaning the grease and the dirt of many years off your window. So when you look through it, you see very clearly what is inside. One of the obstacles to the development of awareness, I said before, is the way we've been trained. The way we've been taught to look. How do we look? You look with name. You look at me and what do you say? Mat, Ajahn Brahm. The way to look with mindfulness, with penetrating mindfulness, is to be able to look without knowing. When you look without knowing, you look even deeper. And deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. The names which come up is what you've been taught. If you really wish to develop the mindfulness which penetrates, you have to let go of all that you've been taught. It's like one look, say the Buddha statue behind me. What is that Buddha? And somebody was talking about a professor in Harvard at the turn of the century. He selected his students in the following way. He would take out a fish and ask his students, what is this? The student would say, it is a fish. Look again. They would look even deeper. And they'd say, it's got gills, it's got scales. Look even deeper. These first students had to spend about 12 or 14 hours every day for 5 days just looking at a fish. After a while, they got the point. After 5 days of clear looking, they still hadn't completed their knowledge of the fish. To explain this, I will say that the longer one looks, the more one sees. And one doesn't complete the seeing. Usually, we stop seeing. Why? Because we look at the fish, we give it a name, and we think we've completed the task, and we go on to something else. The mindfulness, the investigation, the awareness is not sustained. And all it sees is what's on the surface. If you manage to develop a powerful awareness, through meditation or whatever, you start to see much, much more. Not just the surface, but something much deeper. One of the powerful experiences I remember as a layperson practicing meditation as a student, once we had a meditation retreat for 10 days. Every morning we were allowed to go for a walk for 1 hour. And the meditation was not in a camp or a retreat center in those days, it was just a group of houses in a street in a provincial city in England, which were hired. Fortunately, that within 5 minutes' walk was a local botanical garden. And I used to go there to exercise for the walk at the morning before breakfast on this meditation retreat. At the entrance to the botanical gardens was a clump of bamboo, and I never progressed further than that clump. And for 10 days, for 1 hour every morning, I sat down on a bench and just watched those bamboos. I never completed my investigation, my watching of that clump. When awareness becomes strong, you see so much more of what's happening there in a clump of bamboo. Both the shape and the colour and the texture and the movement. All that went into that clump of bamboo was growing greater and greater the more I watched. I'd gone past that clump of bamboo many times before as a student, but not while I was meditating. When I went past before, this bamboo. Everyone knows what a bamboo is. You go past. But when you're meditating and your mind is bright and fully aware, there's so much there, you can spend hour after hour and still not complete all that there's there to see. This is what I mean by mindfulness. When the mind is bright and full of power, it penetrates much deeper and sees so much more. The way of Buddhism is developing such a powerful mindfulness and applying it in certain areas of one's life. Not just seeing the superficial, the names, bamboo, Buddha, or monk, but seeing much deeper. Because that which we call reality, truth, the essence of things, is not found easily. It takes the deep and penetrating power of the mind we call sustained awareness. Then the first thing the Buddha says in the teaching of Satipatthana is to develop the mind so it gains that degree of mindfulness. And the path to gain that degree of mindfulness is just this meditation. It's a training of the mind, a developing of the mind. It is gaining some ability which is there for the taking, which many people do not bother to take. The mind can be a very powerful tool, very penetrating and bright. Often this is of laziness, to just allow it to sort of atrophy. If we really want to find the truth of our existence, if we really want to find about ourselves, if we really want to know, what can you know with your mind? Is your mind really developed enough, strong enough, sharp enough to know? Can it maintain its attention, full awareness on your object of your investigation? If a mind can only look for a second and then go somewhere else, can that sort of mind really penetrate to the truth? One needs to develop the ability to be clearly aware and to sustain that awareness for long periods of time. The clear awareness is like the sharpness of a knife. Sustaining of that awareness is pressing that knife for a long period of time, getting deeper and deeper until one reaches the core. So the Buddha said in this Four Foundations of Mindfulness, one begins by developing an awareness which is free from the defilements, which is energetic and powerful and penetrating. And then he said to point this awareness in one of four places. When I first developed this awareness, I pointed it at a clump of bamboo. Very interesting and absorbing, and you saw things there which I'd never seen before, but it never made me enlightened. It was just sort of interesting and fascinating. People who have religious experiences often develop that degree of mindfulness, and they put it on a tree and see just how beautiful and deep a tree can be. Children can do this very easily, I often say, with a blade of grass or a little insect. You find them in the grass, just spending hours watching something we would just pass over. The ability to be clearly aware and sustain that interest and that attention. It's fascinating. But the Buddha said, if you really want to become enlightened, put it on four things. And those four things are all in here. Instead of out there, the Buddha said, look inside. There was once a story of the Buddha told of one of his monks who in a previous life had practiced as a yogi, developing his meditation in a deep forest jungle, and to the point where he could levitate not just for a few inches or a few feet, but could go through the air with the ease he could walk. And he developed the idea, where did this universe end? So this is in the Buddhist scriptures. He went into outer space trying to find the end of the universe. As way away from planet to solar system to different places, as it said in this sutta, teaching of the Buddha. And he died. He passed away in space long before he found the end of the universe. When he got reborn, he still had this idea, where is the end of this universe? And eventually he asked the Buddha, where do you find the end of the universe? In my previous life, I've been traveling so far into outer space. Where is the end of this universe? So you silly monk, said the Buddha. You never find the end of the universe that way. You find the end of the universe by looking inside. And that monk understood. He found the end of the universe inside his own body and mind. You'll find the beginning of the universe as well as its end inside your own body and mind. I'm not talking about Big Bang. In Buddhism there was a Big Bang before the Big Bang and one before that. Time after time. Many world cycles, hundreds, thousands, millions of world cycles, millions of universes expanding and contracting. This beginning is what was before the beginning, another beginning. And before that, a beginning before. The Buddha said the beginnings go on. You never find the end that way, nor the beginning. You only find the end by looking inside. That's why these four foundations of mindfulness are taking that power of the mind, that clear, bright awareness developed in meditation, and pointing it inside. Focusing it on four things. First of all, your body. Your arms, your leg, your head, your brain, your heart. What is this thing you call a body? How does it work? The Buddha said that if you develop this full awareness, not just the ordinary awareness, this full awareness, this deep awareness on your body, you see it for what it is. Not for what you hope it is, not for what you think it is, but for what it actually is. And what it actually is just a group of material elements coming together and passing away again, just like everything else in this universe and no difference. Just like a tree, just like a car, just like a mountain, just like a sunset. No more, no less. Working according to its natural laws, not according to how you want it to be. The natural laws of all phenomena which one sees in the world is to arise, and when it arises, it is beautiful and attractive. As it decays and passes away, its attraction decreases, and eventually it passes away. It comes together and then it disperses into other elements. Just as your body has been a collection of so many other different elements. I remember being quite moved when I was studying science to be told that the only way the elements of your body, especially heavier elements, such as iron and the like, the only way that these can be formed in this universe is in the very bowels of the sun. Not the sun, which we know, but other suns which have lived and died. And when they died in a huge explosion they call a nova or a supernova. And as that sun exploded, it sent its parts streaming through the universe with cosmic dust. Some of that cosmic dust congealed into other solar systems, created new suns, which in turn exploded, sending that dust flying through the universe. And a small part of that congealed as part of this solar system, in this planet we call Earth. And part of that through the eating of food is part of our body. If one asks the molecules in one's body where they have been, twice in their history they've been part of this huge stellar explosion. It's the only way these elements could come about. You've been part of two supernovas. This is just the elements coming together and passing away, no more. But we take this as being mine, our body, and become concerned. When we look at the body with full awareness, our attachment to things like beauty and health and long life disappear. If we look not what we want to see, but what's really there, we'll see that this body is going on a course of development which we cannot stop. If we fully knew that, there would be no attachment to this body. But there would be care, but not attachment. The difference between care and attachment is care puts forth the same amount of protective energy, but when one doesn't get one's way, when things go wrong, when the body starts to decay in sickness and then in death, the difference between care and attachment is that care can let go, attachment does not. If one could only understand with full awareness the nature of our body, when someone dies, we would never cry, because we would understand the nature of the body, the nature of these compounded elements is just this. When the body becomes sick, you would just know this is the nature of our body. The Buddha was saying that these are not things we just believe in, these are things we see with deep awareness. Awareness which goes much deeper than what we want life to be, but which has the power to disappoint our wishes for the cause of truth. As I said here before, insight is what shocks one. Insight is not confirming what you want to believe, but insight, true understanding, is seeing what this world truly is. The second focus of mindfulness is on one's feelings, the feelings of pleasure and the feelings of pain. With full mindfulness, deep penetrating mindfulness, we look at this play, the feelings between pleasure and pain and that which lies in between. Because we don't know fully that which we call pleasure and that which we call pain, we are in a constant search for that which is just pleasure, and a constant fleeing and fear from that which we call pain. That which is pleasure and pain creates such a problem for us, so we become in this constant searching and fleeing, desire and fear, for these two natural parts of human existence. True mindfulness will tell you that pleasure and pain come together as a pair, and you cannot separate one from the other. Trying to separate pleasure from pain is the quest of the unenlightened being who search for that which is just pleasure and try and eradicate that which is pain. We spend our whole lives, many lives, in this hopeless quest. And that means we never accept pain, and we always try and cling on to pleasure. If you look with mindfulness, the mindfulness which doesn't expect what it might find, the mindfulness which can hold truth so high, you'll be willing to sacrifice what you want on the altar of truth. You'll accept what's true rather than what you want to see. If one has that power of mindfulness, one will see that pleasure is the gap between two painful experiences, or pain is a gap between two pleasurable experiences. And the amount of pleasure is directly related to the pain that went before. One of the moving experiences I had many years ago at the airport in Perth, some refugees came from Iran. These were Baha'i refugees who'd been persecuted in the revolution, the Islamic revolution, led by the Ayatollah Khomeini. These refugees had been persecuted for 1 or 2 years. They'd fled their homes in fear, having lost many members of their family to torture and death. They themselves had left with no possessions. Many of them were quite wealthy. They had to leave everything behind to an unknown future, fleeing out of fear, not knowing where they would go. After 1 or 2 years languishing in refugee camps in Pakistan, some of these eventually came to Perth. I was at the airport waiting for a monk. When these refugees came through, they threw up their hands and shouted in joy. Their friends shouted as well. And before I know it, I was shouting as well. There was such euphoria in the airport. It was like a party, as if someone had won the lotto or someone had gained some tremendous prize. And you felt such happiness and joy. I often wondered why that was. Why was this one of the most happiest occasions I could remember? I wasn't a Baha'i, I was a Buddhist. I didn't even know these people. And soon I realized that it is clear reflection, common sense, their happiness, which was enormous, was directly related to the pain of 2 years had gone by. Without that pain, that happiness would not be there. Much which we call happiness is just a release of pain. A release of the thirst, a release of the search. The more you think of the holiday you're going to go on, the harder it is to get there, the more you enjoy it once you reach there. The more you save up for that beautiful house, the harder it is to get, the happier it is when you reach your aim. How much of our happiness is paid for by much pain? When you look at it this way, when you see happiness and pain with deep mindfulness, you start to realize their connection. When you start to realize their connection, you neither become attached to happiness nor to pain. By not becoming attached to it, one realizes these are a natural part of life. Just as the winter and the summer, the drought and the rain, the old age and youth, dark and bright, happiness and pain are just this. When one understands feeling in its true nature, not as something in your power to control, but as the nature of a human being who feels, who is sensitive, one can accept both with equal equanimity. Happiness and pain are both our lot. You become a human being, this is what you have to accept. So we don't spend so much time crying when things become painful. We don't spend so much time thinking, at last I've got it right, when we fear experiences of pleasure. Moreover, we don't spend our time just searching for pleasure here and there, again and again. This elusive thing which we call pleasure, which we think is just in our grasp and then disappears. And worried why it is that we feel so much pain and disappointment in our life, we realize, this is natural. This is part of life. When you accept these things, what a relief. There is a Zen saying of this monk who became enlightened, and his first remark, once he was enlightened, happiness at last, to know there's no happiness in the world. Once you understand that, you understand something of what we mean by enlightenment. Oh, what a relief to be free from this quest for happiness and this fleeing from pain. When you can accept both, the stress and the strain of life is gone. You're at peace, equanimous, serene with whatever comes. And you know when you stop fighting, you get more happiness and less pain. So the second foundation of mindfulness is putting your attention on just these things. The pleasure and the pain which so obsess human beings in this world. Obsessed with these things, not knowing what they are. The third foundation of mindfulness is the mindfulness which looks on consciousness itself. The things we call consciousness, you're so caught up with what you think of as you, as a self, as me. But does anyone really know what consciousness really means? For many it's just a word which you've never really seen and investigated and known with deep insight and understanding. This third foundation of mindfulness is one of the most difficult to perform. You have to have just a very clear and powerful mind. And turn it in so you notice this process which we call consciousness so clearly that you see it as just a rising and a falling. But consciousness is not something which is continuous. Consciousness is just moments of consciousness, no more. Like those old films they used to have maybe 50, 60, 70 years ago. Just frames which were moved so quickly. Still frames which gave the illusion of movement. The mind which develops in meditation can have such power that it can see just moments of consciousness arising one after the other. What happens when one moment of consciousness arises and passes away? It passes away into nothing. Into emptiness, into void. And another moment of consciousness emerges from you. Like a river passing through the city. That river is just molecules of water. Passing by, coming into your vision, and then passing out again to the sea. We think that river is something. We don't realize that river we saw this morning is not the same as the river we see this afternoon. It is completely different. This is our consciousness this morning and our consciousness this afternoon. It's a completely different phenomenon. Once we understand this thing which we call consciousness, we have a very good understanding of this thing we call I, me, the self, or soul. Moreover, because consciousness is a way we know the world, it is the means by which we understand the world outside and the world within. Through that which we call consciousness, it gives a profound understanding of the nature of everything. We perceive through consciousness, we understand through consciousness. And the world can be seen as a manifestation of our consciousness. Once we understand what this consciousness is, just from the rising and passing, we can say that the world is just the same, from the rising and passing. And when it goes, it's nothing left. That which we call emptiness and void is something which many mystics have touched in their meditation. It is something which has inspired many generations of religious art to somehow point to what I'm talking about now, that which we call emptiness and joy and ocean. It's hard for the human mind to get a grip on what I mean, because we always try to put a label on the void. We always try and put a wall around space. You cannot put a wall around space, no more than you can hang a sign with a nail in the air. These things we have to let the mind go towards. Emptiness, void, complete cessation. Through mindfulness we can see this, experiencing it rather than thinking about it. And that's why this third focus of mindfulness is the one most difficult of all. Because to do this we have to give up everything. Everything which we hold dear. We have to let go. Even of itself, to experience true consciousness in relation to that which we call the void. Consciousness and the void are the ultimate duality. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is the object of the mind. This is a huge area where we can allow the mindfulness to investigate. This is all our thoughts, our emotions, and our perceptions. These objects of the mind we often take to be solid and real. That which we think we take to be true. The Buddha is saying, be careful. One of my favorite sayings which the Buddha said was, whatever you think it is, there is always something else. The mind is saying it is. Whatever you think it is, it's something else. What does that do? It stops you trusting in thought. So much of our world relies on our thought. Your opinion of another, your opinion of yourself. These are all thoughts. These are being built up in the mind. You should all have enough experience of life already to know that you cannot trust these things. The way you think of another, can you trust that at all? One day you will love them, the next you will hate them. These are just extremes. Usually most people are somewhere in between. All these thoughts which we have about another person are just built up in many perceptions. These are all inaccurate. There are just ideas which come up into our mind which we take to be real. Just ways of looking that we know, we should know anyway. We have to look for an eternity to really know for sure. How can you ever know another human being? Do you know yourself? Do we think we know? And we think we know ourselves. We think we know ourselves so much that we can have an opinion of ourselves. I am hopeless. I am terrible. I am great. I am really fine. I am better than you. You are better than me. All sorts of thoughts that can come up into our mind, we believe and we take for truth, and they give rise to pride or depression. It's frightening to give up something which we've invested so much care and time and effort in. I'm saying, can you trust these things called thought? These things arise and pass away. That's all they are. It flashes in the sky like the meteors which have been falling over Earth. Flash and they're gone. Disintegrates into dust with no remains. We take them for truth. We can fight wars over thoughts and ideas. When you let them go, that's all they are. The flat is in the sky. That is in the sky of the mind, which, if you think, has something more than they are, creates so much problems and difficulties for human beings. Perceptions are the same. These first ideas which arise in the mind, good, bad, beautiful, ugly. Do you really know what beauty is? What ugliness? I saw a photo in a magazine of some of the beautiful models of the 60s. When I was a young man, I thought these were beautiful women. And I wondered, what's beautiful about them? Our perceptions have changed. Do your perceptions change in this way? What is beautiful? What is ugly? It's a perception which arises in the mind conditioned by what we're expected to do. These things are implanted in us, like brainwashed into us. They're not real, they're not truth, they're not solid. But beauty and ugliness obsess our mind. We search and protect that which we think is beautiful. We pay lots of money to gain beauty in our house, to gain beauty in our body, to have beauty in our world, and to avoid that which we think is ugly. Isn't beautiful and ugly just the duality, just like happiness and pain? That beauty is just the release from ugliness. Ugliness is just a space between two beautiful things. Aren't they so together that you cannot have one without the other? When you know you have to have both, they come together like night and day. You accept them with equanimity. But peace, this is part of our life. Perceptions and thoughts create problems for the human being because we don't understand them. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness investigates these things. It investigates these things ruthlessly. When I say ruthlessly, there's no sacred cow one is going to keep. If this is what they truly are, one is willing to accept it. When one accepts it, there's peace. And there's freedom. And there's enlightenment. This, the Buddha said, is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Investigating with this powerful penetration of a fully aware, empowered, bright, penetrating mind. It sees more than the superficial, it sees deep into the very nature of these things. Developed through meditation, this mindfulness becomes powerful. And it's pointed in these four areas. Your body, the feelings of pleasure and pain, the consciousness itself, and the perceptions and thoughts which we taste as being real and solid. The result of this meditation, the result of this mindful investigation, see these things for what they truly are. And the result of this, whether one likes it or not, without one choosing, without one making a choice, is to let go and be equanimous. Never again fighting for one against the other. Someone who understands that both are your heritage. You accept and let go, and at last, you're at peace. So at the beginning, do you want to become enlightened? Mm-hmm. This is how you do it, and this is what it is. Has anyone got any questions or comments about this evening's talk? We have one question from the rest. Yes, Robin. Is Nibbana nothingness? Nibbana is the Pali term for Nirvana, which is not a thought group. It's It is a set is nothingness, and nirvana is the end of the problem, so it's no problem. No attachment, no suffering, no trying to control all of this. It's understanding full awareness. In this way, the Buddha said, nirvana is happiness, ultimate happiness. You can understand when I'm saying that happiness and suffering are just parts of a pair. When one understands these things, one lets go. And that freedom from that struggle to gain happiness and to avoid unhappiness, the freedom from that struggle is true happiness. And that's what I meant by that Zen monk who said, happiness at last, to know there's no happiness. Sometimes these paradoxes are very useful as teaching devices, because they make us look deeper than what's superficial. Happiness at last, to know there's no happiness. On the surface it makes no sense. On the surface it's a contradiction in terms. So it's a marvelous tool to look deep in the mind. When you realize there's no happiness, at last is happiness there. It sounds a contradiction, but that's the way it works. So that's what nirvana is, as one experiences it here in this life. That's how it will happen. When you release from the struggle, what a relief. Are you still struggling? Another question, yeah? Do you have to become a monk to become enlightened? It helps enormously to become a monk or a nun to become enlightened. I think that's a good enough answer. Or do you want to? That's why the Buddha established the monastic life. Remember historically that monasticism wasn't some sort of tradition which the Buddha inherited. He actually started this thing off. They say that the first true monasticism in the world started with Buddhism. In fact, lots of monasteries and people living a monastic celibate life. Why did he start this off? The Buddha didn't do things for no reason. This was a really wise person. And the reason why the Buddha established monasticism is because it helped enormously for a man or a woman who really wishes to become enlightened, to have the facilities of peace, the time, to develop the mind, to liberate the mind. It's hard, there's so many things to do in this world. And the world calls you in one direction. In a monastery, a good monastery, is pulling you towards enlightenment. That's the meaning of a monastery, that's its function, that's its purpose. In a good monastery, everything is shouting at you, go towards enlightenment. Let go of one's struggle. And if you don't go in that direction, you can't stay in a monastery. So that's the meaning of monasticism in Buddhism. So it helps enormously. Some people managed in the time of the Buddha to become almost enlightened as a layperson, man or woman. But once they became fully enlightened, they either became a monk, or they left the world and passed away. If one understands what enlightenment means, one can understand why. Once one is enlightened, there's no reason to keep on living, unless it is to help others. The way one helps others is by setting an example, by teaching, And the best vehicle is always that of monasticism. Someone who's enlightened, even if they don't live in a monastery, that is like a monk or nun. Remember some of these things I've been talking about, detachment, freedom from this search for happiness and suffering. One of the things which one gives up is the search for happiness in sexuality. Anyone who is enlightened will be celibate. It is, it comes with a thing. You can't sort of get away from it. And that's why that the celibacy has always been part of monasticism. While the Buddha was celibate, he didn't take a wife. And the nuns who were enlightened, they didn't go and get married afterwards. Now I've got enlightened, I can sort of enjoy myself now, I've got that out of the way. So, but the monasticism has a very powerful and central part to the path of Buddhism. It's open to each one of you. Why don't you want to become a monk? Why don't you want to become a nun? I'll leave you with that question. I think that's probably enough for this evening. If you have another question, please come up and ask it personally afterwards. There are some announcements which should be made, so please stay for a little bit longer while we make these announcements. Maybe I'll make the announcement that way, Fletcher? Yeah. Okay, you can go.
Just a couple of quick announcements. First of all, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to those who are first time here, and hope your visit here is meaningful. Okay, just a quick reminder, advanced Dharma class will be held this Sunday at 3 p.m. Introduction to meditation classes beginning tomorrow is the first of the 4 weeks course, and it's going to be conducted by Ajahn Brahm. It's open to the public and it's free of charge. 3 to 4. And lastly, is a Sri Lankan vegetarian dinner that will be held on Sunday, 28th of May. Tickets are on sale at the counter, and it's $7 for adults and $4 for children. And we hope you will support this dinner, and the money collected will help us to reduce the loan and pay some of our bills.
Thank you. The other announcement which I was going to make this evening was a week's time on the 14th of May. It is a traditional Buddhist celebration. It's called Waisak, in Thai Waisaka Puja, in Cambodian Waisaka Pujia. This is the celebration which remembers the birth, the enlightenment, and the final passing away of the Buddha. And as such, it's the most important day in the Buddhist calendar. It happens on the full moon of May every year, and the full moon falls on a Sunday this year, and so we're having a celebration here in Nornamara on the Sunday. That celebration, we try and make it important and useful for all people. There's a program in the newsletter. There's a slight change to that program, and I'll just read out the program. At 9 o'clock in the morning is the gathering here. At 9:30 there will be some auspicious chanting, the traditional chanting by the monks, followed by the 3 lectures and 5 precepts. The 8 precepts for those people who are keeping 8 precepts that day. The 8 precepts are like staying in a monastery for the day. One is giving up, especially eating in the afternoon. One just eats in the morning. No entertainment to distract one. And no adornments to body, such as makeup or jewelry. The idea here being that one sees the body as it truly is. and one doesn't distract oneself with television or radio, which takes one's mind off reflecting on the truth of things. So the eight precepts on this Visakha day is a usual way which many Buddhists celebrate this day. The reason they do this is for the sake of really investigating the truth of their body and their mind, and not wasting time. Again, after 9:30 will be a short Dharma talk. And at 10:30 we have the usual night feast, the sharing of a meal together. In the afternoon at 2 o'clock, as we have done every year for the past few years, it's an opportunity for those of you who wish to take the three refuges and the five precepts for the first time. And I will give those three refuges and five precepts at 2 o'clock to whoever wishes to take them for the first time, and also give a Dharma talk to you on the meaning of these things. The three refuges and the five precepts have been traditionally the way in which one affirms that one is a Buddhist. Affirming one is a Buddhist means just acknowledging that the way one is practicing, the way one looks at life, has a name. It's Buddhism. There comes a time in one's life, if one comes here, that one is so close to these teachings and makes so much sense to one, that one wants to actually form this knowledge to oneself or anyone else, that this is one's path. One takes these three refuges and five precepts as acknowledgement of this. It becomes a very moving experience for many people. And the five precepts are the basic precepts that one abstains from deliberately killing living beings, abstains from taking what's not yours, in other words, stealing, not misusing sexuality, not lying, and not taking alcohol or drugs which cause intoxication. And one does this realizing the purpose and the usefulness of these things. So that'll be at 2 o'clock. On the 14th, and if you wish to come, just come. You don't need to make an appointment, but make sure that you know what you're doing. And this is not just an empty ceremony, but this is a meaningful acknowledgement of where one is in one's spiritual path. At 4 o'clock, there is a cup of tea and biscuits, for those not on 8 precepts, and there is some meditation and discussion during this time. So 4 and 6, between 4 and 6 on the Sunday the 14th, will be a meditation, a talk, or a discussion at this, during this time. So if you wish to come for an extra Dhamma talk, extra meditation on the Sunday between 4 and 6. At 6 o'clock, there is a traditional flower puja, where one offers flowers, incense, and things to the Buddha. This is done as a gesture of generosity. The Buddha will not eat these things, the Buddha will not smell the flowers. But nevertheless, it is still a worthy thing to do, because it is an act of gratitude and respect to someone who has meant something to you. Just like in some Buddhist tradition, in our Buddhist tradition, sometimes we do things in honor of our deceased parents. Even though they may not be able to see these things or eat this food, it is still a worthy thing to do to remember someone who has helped you and served you, and has meant so much to you. There's also usually a short Dhamma talk during the flower puja, and I'd encourage as many as possible, if they want to come and join in, the flower puja between 6 and 7. Between 7 and 7:30, there'll be some traditional Sri Lankan Buddhist devotional songs, which is the tradition in Sri Lanka to have young people doing some traditional chanting. It's usually, again, very enjoyable. And I always like the last part of the ceremony between 7:30 and 8:30, where carrying candles and incense, we circumambulate, walking round the shrine which we set up in the park opposite. We do this silently, meditatively, reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We do these things as an act of, again, gratitude. These things have meant something to you. One thinks of these things and says thank you in one's heart. Walking around with these things as offerings to that which one has found to be a marvelous light and guide in the world. The Buddha, the teacher, the Dhamma, the teaching, and the Sangha, the community of those who have kept and preserved and practiced those teachings for 25 centuries. and that's again sometimes the most moving part of the Vaisakha ceremony. So that program is in the newsletter. If you are free at any time of that day, I'd encourage you to come along. If you want to come for the whole day, please come along. That's the Vaisakha day, traditional, meaningful Buddhist ceremony on Sunday the 14th of May. So now you see, pay, and again, an act of gratitude to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha by bowing and doing chanting. If you wish to stay for a cup of tea, again, you're most welcome.
Sukhapihano bhagavato sāvaka-sāṅkho